Hello, I'm Michael Barclay. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Private Passions from BBC Radio 3. Every week on Private Passions, I talk to guests from all walks of life about their choice of music. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the series, please visit the Radio 3 website. I hope you enjoy the programme. For Lubeno Himid, winning the Turner Prize is recognition for 35 years as a painter, curator, and installation artist. Her work is witty, vibrantly coloured, and provocative. In her most famous piece, Naming the Money, she filled galleries with more than 100 huge and very beautiful cutouts of African figures from the past, the forgotten black servants and musicians who were brought back by their slave masters to live in Britain in the 18th century. Lubeno Himid herself was born in Zanzibar, Tanzania, but she came here as a baby, first to Blackpool and then to London. She now lives in Preston, where she's Professor of Contemporary Art at the University of Central Lancashire. She was awarded an MBE for services to black women's art. And she said, "My work is a mixture of humour, celebration, optimism and fury. I want to challenge the order of things." Now, fury, that's quite a striking word, Lubeno.
Yes, well, I think it's necessary. It's absolutely necessary to be furious in order to energise oneself into making a difference. It doesn't have to be violent fury, but it's absolutely determination and, I don't know, a burning desire to make a difference.
It's like a fuel rod.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how does winning the Turner Prize change your perspective? After all, that is the ultimate recognition from the art establishment.
Yes, well, I think that it has made a difference. It's made me more experimental. It's made me more daring. And I suppose I've allowed my confidence to kind of come to the surface.
Music, I know you sometimes use as a soundtrack to your installations, Lubeno. And is it also the soundtrack to your own daily life, for example, at home or in the studio?
Yes, well, when I have it playing at home and when I'm working in my studio at home, it's something to work against. It is absolutely a soundtrack, but I'm trying to concentrate on what I'm painting and I want to have the music working against what I'm doing so that I'm working even harder to make the thing real.
So there's a friction.
Absolutely, yes.
So for that reason, probably words would be too distracting.
Well, speech. Yes, definitely speech, much too distracting. Strangely, when I'm writing things and I'm trying to concentrate, then I like to have speech on.
Ah, you have a very interesting brain. You trained first as a theatre designer, and there is something theatrical about your work, especially Naming the Money. So I wasn't surprised to see that opera features on your list. Mm. Wimbledon College of Art gave you the opportunity, didn't it, to work with opera, to design Norma, in fact, Bellini's Norma.
Yes, it was one of the first exercises, one of the first projects that the tutors there gave us was to design the sets and the costumes for Norma. And I hadn't really encountered opera right at the front of my brain ever before I went to art school. And I immediately understood that kind of huge potential for visualization, for emotional engagement, and that kind of all-round experience.
There are two women involved in this dialogue, if you like, but what they're actually singing about is quite dark, isn't it?
It is, yes. It's a plea, I suppose, for one woman to the other woman not to kill herself. But I guess what I love about the music, I love about the song, I love about the duet, is that there's an intertwining, there's an understanding between these two women, a certain inevitability about what may happen, and a deep understanding of each other.
So this is the intimacy and the confessional nature of what is happening. And in fact, I think Norma's thinking even of killing her children.
Absolutely. And yet, somehow it seems to me that if you were even imagining that that was a possibility, you could only have that conversation with another woman.
Joan Sutherland and Marilyn Horne in music from Act 3 of Bellini's Norma. Richard Bonning was conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. So, Lubaina Hamid, you were born in Zanzibar, as we said, but then after your father died, your mum brought you back to her family in Blackpool when you were just a baby. And even though you spent so little time in Africa, you say that you always felt as if you were an African being brought up by English people.
Yes, and I sort of felt that in a positive way. My mother tried to talk as much as she could about the small amount of time she'd spent in Zanzibar and tried to tell me everything she could about the place. And I was always encouraged to say that that's where I came from. And we were talking the 1950s here, you know, so people were constantly asking me where I had come from and running their fingers through my hair and saying how cute I was, you know. And that, in a sense, made me understand that I was different. And that was kind of peculiar, but I didn't suffer much in the way of aggressive behaviour. I was more a kind of little exotic creature.
Have you been back to Tanzania and Zanzibar?
Yes, I went back, and in the meantime, of course, I had done a lot of work on really reading about the place, looking at every photograph I could, understanding about the architecture, about the fabrics that women wore, that the clothes that people wear, the music that people listen to. And so when I arrived there, it was like going to Manchester, really. It was just felt, oh, yeah, I know this. I understand this. It feels like home. You know?
I must say, when I went there, I loved it, but I didn't feel I was going to Manchester. But I know what you mean. And that sense of dislocation, of being something of an outsider, I guess also feeds into your visual art.
Yes, it's very important to me that the people from what I would call the black diaspora feel as if they can belong. That feeling of wanting to belong in a place, wanting to belong as part of British culture, has been always very important to me. And I want to fill the gaps in the histories, if you like, to show that all along we were indirectly contributing, and in more recent years, of course, directly contributing to the kind of rich layers, the rich tapestry of what being British is.
Your aunt, I think, brought music into your house, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And my mother was a textile designer. My aunt was a musician, and she was a teacher.
She played the violin.
She did, and she played the violin very, very beautifully. And I guess she encouraged me, shall I say, she thought it was very good for my discipline to learn an instrument. I'm not sure it was that good for my discipline, but I learned the cello because she encouraged me and thought that it would be fun for me to do so.
I think the cello and that experience of learning the cello at school leads us very directly into this next piece, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think I thought that I wouldn't have to do awfully much work to be able to play the cello or to play the cello well or to be able to play like Jacqueline Dupré. And I very soon learned that it was an incredible amount of work, and I understood that being a musician was not for me, but that listening was how I was going to participate in music. And this piece that Jacqueline Dupré is playing by Bruch was something I dearly would love to be able to play.
Jacqueline Dupré with Bruch's Col Nidre. The pianist was Gerald Moore. Interesting how, as somebody who's played the cello, you know that that lower register is very rich, isn't it? But when you take it up into the treble clef, it has a kind of yearning, plangent sound, which is rather appropriate for this piece, don't you think?
Absolutely, yes. It somehow seems like a magical instrument, really, that it can do so much. It's incredible.
You must have had fun playing it.
Oh, I did. I absolutely had fun. I just knew I wasn't very good.
Do you ever have a go on it now? Or?
No, I don't.
You should do.
I should.
And actually, that music was part of the soundtrack you made for the installation we mentioned at the beginning of the programme, Naming the Money. Why do you want people to listen to music while they look at your paintings? Do you think that changes the way they see, or perhaps puts in mind what you saw in your mind's ear, if you like?
Well, I think Naming the Money, you see, was a piece in which an audience was invited to walk in amongst the people that I had made. So you were kind of talking to these people, reading about their lives, that was written on the back of the cutouts themselves. And then it would depend how long you spent in the installation or when you turned up, what kind of music you would hear. And so I suppose it gave it a different colour, gave it a different shape, depending how long you spent and whether something that was being played on the soundtrack resonated with you. And you could also hear the texts, these people's lives, as you walked around. So if you were not the sort of person who wanted to read when you were in an art gallery, you wanted to simply drift and think and have imaginary conversations, I thought the music would help.
Why did you call it Naming the Money?
I think it was very important for me. I couldn't decide really whether naming was more important or money was more important. And in a sense, it's being clear. I wanted to be clear that the piece is about how to belong, how to be part of things. But the trauma that we found ourselves in, that was the slave trade, was absolutely all about money.
Do artists talk enough about money for work, naming the money, if you like, and doing things for free?
Well, we do amongst ourselves. I think because being an artist looks like such a pleasurable thing, something that you would do because you enjoy it, because it's fun. And of course, coming up with the idea is enjoyable and fun, and then the doing it is a hell of a slog, which is, of course, what I didn't realise about playing the cello. And so, it's getting that balance right, that making work, being creative, is it's a real thing. It's a real job. It's a real contribution. And there ought to be considerations about paying well for it.
I wonder whether you would agree with my composition teacher, Richard Rodney Bennett, when he said to me, look, Michael, ideas are easy. We all have ideas. It's what you do with them that where the work comes in.
Yes, I mean, I totally agree. As I say, the ideas are not so much the easy bit, but that's the glorious bit. And then you just have to knuckle down till it's done.
And do you get ideas sometimes in bed or walking or away from the studio?
Definitely. Yes, absolutely definitely. And also what happens to me when I'm making work is I very often see places in which I've had the idea. There are certain sort of bits of pavement in London where I remember having a particular idea.
The next piece was something else you used on that exhibition soundtrack too, though it's very different from the last music we heard. It's a song by the Irish folk singer Dolores Keane.
Yes, and this song, again, is a kind of a friendship song, I suppose I would think of it, where in a sense, you're being told that you don't have to be the best. You don't have to be the shiniest. You just have to be yourself and you have to try to do what you can. And to do what you can in the friendship is how I've always looked at it, but to do what you can in the world. And that's incredibly important to me.
Turning in the sky, and you won't be the bone above us.
Never Be the Sun, Dolores Keane from her 1993 album Solid Ground. Actually, she was doing there what Bellini was doing, moving two female voices around in thirds, but I suspect she was double-tracking herself
okay.
there.
All right.
Bellini didn't have the technology,
no.
So he needed two singers. The mid-80s and early 90s were quite a difficult time, I think, Lubaina Hamid. Tough trying to make a living after you'd finished your MA at the Royal College of Art. I think you worked as a waitress for a while.
Yes, I did. I have to say, I was working as a waitress in a space that I'd helped design, but nonetheless, because I didn't get paid very much for designing it. So
you were a rather superior waitress.
No, a useless waitress, actually. One that forgot things.
And then at one point you earned money sewing costumes at the Royal Opera House in London.
Yes, and because, of course, I'd done a theatre course, so I knew a lot of people who worked at the Opera House, and occasionally there was too much work for them to do, and so they called up all their friends, and I was one of them, just to do some extra work, really. That's about as near as I got.
Well, you can tell me the truth about something. When I was working there, I was always rather fascinated that in the costume department, they'd worked out that it was much more economical to use the best materials, because if you used cheaper ones, they just didn't last very long, and they sweat, for example, ruined them. Was that your experience?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Singers, performers are rough, tough people, and, you know, the things wear out really fast. No, and anyway, it's much more pleasurable to wear fine quality things, yes, when you're supposed to be, you know, someone else.
You produced some very funny and trenchant satires in the 1980s, most famously an updating of Hogarth's Marriage à la Mode, which involved Thatcher and Reagan. And I wonder what gave you the idea of translating Hogarth into modern Britain, or maybe you see modern Britain in a very Hogarthian way.
Yes, I think that everything is there to be laughed at, everything is there to be made fun of, including, you know, myself as a black woman artist. In that particular cutout installation, the figure of the black woman artist was enormous and rather grand. And I think now that that was rather funny of me to do that, although I'm not sure.
But I've always thought there is a kind of fury in Hogarth. I mean, there's something quite cruel in some ways in his depiction of the realities of human consumption and overconsumption.
Yes, I mean, absolutely no one escaped from that. He was utterly vicious, but I don't know, he did me the favour anyway of depicting life, 18th century life, and one could see that black people even then were part of that life. And that was an absolute gift to me.
Do you feel that you're part of a group of black women artists, or are you out on your own?
No, I think that's the most important thing of all, is that we are a group, but we're not a kind of fixed, tight group like, you know, Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood or something. But for 30-odd years, I've known some of the same women. We made work together for exhibitions in community centres and small art centres in the 1980s. We've known each other ever since. We've tried to encourage younger women over the years to talk with us, come and see how the mistakes that we made, and try to encourage them to keep going. So it's a very large, ever-moving and ever-changing group of people. But no, I mean, one of the most important things to me is that I couldn't have done it on my own. I don't see myself as an individual person. You know, that kind of lone genius thing doesn't sit at all well.
And do you feel that real progress in terms of the group has been made?
Yes, I think so. If you think about being part of British cultural life was important, and now many of us have our work in the National Collection at the Tate, in the Arts Council Collection, we've shown at the V&A, at the Haywood. I think those are important things. They're important milestones. Those are places that are free to go to, and so that people can understand that they too can be part of British life. It's vital.
Keith Jarrett next, and an extract from the best-selling album The Cologne Concert, music I think you first heard here on Radio 3 and which has sustained you ever since.
Yes, I came upon this music. I came upon this music quite by chance. It just happened to be playing, and I immediately understood the imperfection. Yeah, somehow the kind of struggle that was happening, even though I didn't understand how the piece was constructed, and I immediately wanted to hear more of it.
I think this was also important to you, this music, because you were making long journeys to London at the time because your mother was very ill.
Yes, and I still play this music on that journey from Preston to London, even though my mother is much better and now lives up in the north of England as well. But there was something about the music, the way I was able to let go of worrying and just let the train...
Take the strain.
Take the strain, do the work, let Keith Jarrett do the lifting. And the journey then became much shorter. When I'm listening to music, I'm not thinking with my head, and I'm not coming at it from a great experience of understanding how music's constructed. It's very much a thing for me that music helps me understand how I feel.
Music from Keith Jarrett's Cologne Concert from 1975. There's something about the intensity of it, a quality which you were talking about as imperfection, which is interesting. It's the rough edges, isn't it?
Yes, and that's very important to me in the making of my own work, that audiences can see the rough edges, can actually see how I've made something, seeing the materials that I've made the work with, and understand the magic of that. It's not a secret. It's not a special thing. I use materials that I've found, and I make something of them.
Another piece of music now, which is explicitly about grief and loss. This is from the soundtrack of the Polish director Kieslowski's Three Colors trilogy by the Polish composer Zbigniew Preisner. It's played when Juliette Binoche is remembering her dead composer husband. The music which he composed brings his memory alive and becomes erotic as she remembers their lovemaking.
Yes, it's just sensational on every kind of level. And again, it's bringing out what women think, what a woman is thinking, and those different emotions, those different memories together very much make up who we are.
The words are a Polish version of the biblical text about love, "If I speak in the tongues of men and angels." Song for the Unification of Europe, from the original soundtrack to the 1993 film Three Colours Blue by Zbigniew Preissner. Well, we've reached a rather dark point here, Lubina, a meditation on grief and loss, but so much of the subject matter you work with, these stories of slavery, is of course dark. But I wouldn't want to give the impression to people who don't know your work that the overall tone is simply sombre or sad. It's far from that. There's a lot of wit, sexiness and fun too, isn't there?
Yes, I think it's important for me to draw people towards the work with colour, with wit and a sense of come in, let's have this conversation, let's exchange ideas, let's exchange experiences. And yes, underlying is this sense that there are very important and perhaps traumatic things that we need to talk about, but with no way we're going to be able to actually change things unless there is some kind of common ground and sometimes some hilarity and often some sexiness to the whole thing.
Janáček next, and I think you compare this music, which is wonderful writing for the piano and marvellously played here by Leif Ove Andsnes, to the act of drawing.
Yes, there's something about the way Leif Ove Andsnes plays this, where he appears to be, you can tell that I'm not a musician, but he appears to be sucking the music out of the piano rather than banging his fingers on the keys to make the sound come out. And I find actually that's one of the most extraordinary things that I feel about the way that he plays. He somehow draws the music out of the instrument. And then this particular piece of music, I can see the movement, and it's very much in black and white and very sort of swirling lines. And I've kind of grown very fond of it because I look out of my studio window. I can see a lot of bird life. My studio overlooks a park. And I'm very fond of that kind of living in what seems sometimes in the summer months like a treehouse and watching birds kind of dart from place to place. And this music runs parallel with that.
And it's got a wonderful title, "They Chattered Like Swallows." It's from On an Overgrown Path. Thank you. They chattered like swallows from the first volume of Janáček's On an Overgrown Path, and the pianist, wonderful as you say, was Leif Ove Andsnes. I wonder, Lubena Hemid, about the impact of winning the Turner Prize when you're around 63, and are you glad that it came quite late in your career? Although, of course, it would have been made life easier if it had come earlier.
It certainly would. Yes, I think I would have preferred to win it at 43. One of those. It's just one of those things, you know. When you're 63, even if you feel 43, you're kind of very aware that you have less years in front of you than you have behind you. But it has made me think about making work that's even more experimental than work that I've made before. I think a sense of urgency, in a sense, is what's happened to me. I'm thinking, more daringly about work that I might try and make.
But might that have happened anyway as you get older, or do you think it's in the context of winning this prize, which gives you a certain stature, if you like, if that's important, but puts you in a position of slight, where you're more empowered by self-confidence, possibly?
Yes, I think I am more self-confident, and I'm less afraid to fail. Yeah, it's worth taking the risk.
Fascinating to see, therefore, what you'll come up with in the next 10 or 20 years. But perhaps you don't even have an idea yourself.
And certainly not in the next 10 or 20 years. I don't know. I know what I'm... Well, because I'm a bit of a planner. I know what I'm doing, you know, in the next couple of years. I'm moving much more towards work where people can participate within the work themselves and change it in the gallery space.
And that self-confidence, which I think is a very interesting thing in artists, when you achieve something and it's recognised, it does allow one, although this probably can be dangerous too, to sort of relax in one way.
I think maybe if I had won it earlier, I might have relaxed, but it's given me incredible energy and the feeling that I cannot afford to relax.
You've chosen, finally, Nina Simone singing a Bob Dylan song, Just Like a Woman. So why Nina Simone rather than Bob Dylan himself?
Well, because, I mean, I could have chosen any number of Nina Simone songs. There are songs that I listen to of hers that are the soundtrack to the fury that I have, to the sad and unhappy days that I have, and to the kind of wit and, you know, I'm just going to come on, play a couple of tunes, and even though you've, paid your money, I'm going to leave. So, yeah, it's Nina Simone that's the most important to me, and I chose this one because I had to choose one.
She does do it brilliantly.
Absolutely, yeah, and I love the way she's playing the piano. I love it, I love it. It's her owning it, inventing it, as if she wrote it.
Lubena Hemid, thank you very much.
Thank you.
She takes just like a woman. Yes, she does. And she makes love just like a woman.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Private Passions. Search online for Private Passions for more about the programme, pictures and downloads.
But she breaks like a little girl.